on radio, on YouTube, streaming live on investtalk.com, and for our podcast subscribers. This is Invest Talk, independent thinking, shared success. Invest Talk is made possible by KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm serving clients throughout the United States. Here is KPP Financial Portfolio Manager, Luke Guerrero.
Good afternoon, fellow investors, and welcome back to another episode of Invest Talk. I'm your host, Luke Guerrero, and today's Tuesday, January 6th, 2026. Now, I know that Justin was already with you yesterday and last week to ring in the new year, but this is my first show of 2026. And boy, is the year already off, well, to a start, let's say. But as the year turns, as January begins, I want to, for all of us, rededicate ourselves to seeking to achieve that goal we have each and every program. Because our objective for this podcast, for this radio program, for all of our YouTube content, our Instagram content, our webinars, for everything that we put out, is to help make you become a better and more informed investor. We want to help you understand what is happening around and how that affects markets, how that affects your portfolios. To that end, as always, we have a mixture of educational and actionable material to go over today. And in just a bit, we'll talk about today's market performance, as well as running down those show topics. But because the most important part of this show is your finance and investment questions, let's answer this caller question now.
Hi, Luke and Justin. Bill from Philadelphia here. Calling about ticker symbol INVZ, Innoviz Technologies. I'm interested in the LiDAR space. I feel like that is something that is coming up strong in the future, especially with Waymo. And I wanted to get your thoughts on this company. It's an Israeli-based company, and I can see a potential in this for something down the road. I'd love to get your thoughts, and looking forward to hearing your answer on the show. Take care.
INVZ is an Israeli tech company. What they do is they develop and they sell automotive-grade LiDAR. What the heck is LiDAR? Well, LiDAR is light detection and ranging. They are special sensors and perception software that effectively help autonomous driving vehicles figure out depth, right? When you're talking about a picture, effectively what you're just seeing is something that is two-dimensional. LiDAR helps you see that depth. It is how an autonomous vehicle can be able to tell the difference between a white car on a white background. And so understandably, when you have a race from Waymo to now Rivian and all these companies that are trying to integrate LiDAR within their systems, Tesla notably not doing that, companies that are producing this stuff, well, they do stand to benefit. Now, this is a very small company, $274 million market cap with quite a bit of debt in the range of $25 billion. As of 2024. Looking at its chart, it has been heading steadily downward since 2020, in spite of this change in trends. One of the reasons being is LiDAR has become, well, it's become a bit cheaper. And so you're seeing with this company, yes, revenue is exploding, but you're also seeing net income is still negative. It's slightly less negative, but negative nonetheless. EBITDA margin, negative 61.7% is where it's projected to be in 2026. Negative 87.9 is where it was projected to be in 2025. We haven't gotten earnings yet because the fiscal year end for them is December, but it's certainly an improvement from negative 2,811 a few years ago. So we're seeing improvement. This is, because it is pre-profit, going to be a highly speculative company. Shares will have big swings off technical news and sentiment. It'll also be even more volatile because of its size. So I think more than anything, this company that's trading at $1.18 right now is a bit of a gamble. It's up 38% year to date, but the year is certainly young. If you want to invest in LiDAR, if you want to invest in autonomous driving, I find it far better to look for a more established company within the supply chain that'll be less volatile over time. That is Innoviz Technologies, ticker INVZ. Well, we got a lot of ground to cover in the next 45 to 50 minutes or so. And here's a little bit of what we got planned. My main focus point concerns this topic, the January barometer. Wall Street lore says, as goes the first week, so goes the year. So we'll talk about the market's performances in these first 5 days and its historical accuracy as a predictor of future returns. We'll also touch on how America's economy is looking pretty good, especially relative to how many people thought it would be just a few years ago. And now, because of tax legislation, because of fiscal spending, it may continue to accelerate. We'll also touch on a fight brewing between data centers and the cities in which they are occupying. And because of the amount of energy that they're drawing, there's a big fight brewing about shutting down during certain periods. Now, I don't know if you heard this, but a big story out of Venezuela. So how might Venezuelan oil boost U.S. refiners or hurt external producers? We also got some voicemail calls ready to play, including one on 401k contributions and another on the Vanguard International High Dividend Yield Index Fund ETF, ticker VYMI, as well as some questions that came in from the comments section of the InvestTalk YouTube channel, and hopefully some live calls throughout the show. We're going into a break. Please remember, you can call anytime and leave your questions on the InvestTalk voice bank. If you're listening via our live stream or possibly on AM 1220 in the Bay Area, pick up that phone and give me a call now at 888-99-CHART. Hang on, because when we get back, we'll talk about today's market activity.
Serious investors are certain to have finance and investment questions.
What do you think is a good price?
And the best person to ask your question in the right way is you.
And I was wondering, from your standpoint, is there a downside in buying fractional shares versus whole shares?
And 24/7, rain or shine, Justin Klein and Luke Guerrero stand ready to provide their unbiased answers.
But technically, right now, I like it. I like the momentum. But once again, I don't like those fundamentals.
Now, while gold is hitting these record highs, it's driven by the safe haven demand, by central bank buying across the board.
Your participation makes InvestTalk better.
Calling to ask about CORE in Maine.
This is Josh in North Carolina.
This is Marlo from New York City area.
Let's go take a live call. Sam from San Jose.
So don't forget to call InvestTalk.
Great insights. Thank you.
888-99-CHART. It's a new year. 2026 is here, and so is Luke Guerrero. He's taking your finance and investment questions anytime. Call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
888-99-CHART is the number. It will continue to be the number if you have pressing finance and investment questions. So give me a call really any time of day. That being said, let's talk a little bit about the market today. The Dow is up 99 basis points, S&P 500 up 62, NASDAQ up 65, Russell 2000 up 137. Overall, the market higher, ending near their best levels. Dow setting a new all-time high, and the S&P logging its first fresh record close since Christmas Eve. What drove that? Well, memory and storage, semi-cap equipment were the big outperformers on the day. Metals and chemicals also stood out in what was a strong materials sector. You saw machinery, transports, regional banks, retail, restaurants, auto parts, all having a bit of outperformance that fit with this recent pro-cyclical rotation theme. Healthcare bounced from Monday's pullback in defensives, with medtech, pharma, and managed care all seeing some pretty solid gains. Big tech, though, mixed. Amazon, a big outperformer, while Tesla and Apple, some of the underperformers amongst that group. Energy, though, was the worst performing sector, especially with the integrateds and the EMPs showing a bit of weakness. On top of that, data centers, home builders, food and beverage, some telecom names, some of the other underperformers for the day. On the bond side, treasuries were a bit weaker, but came off of their worst levels. Yields were up about 1 basis point across the curve. Dollar index was up 30 basis points. Gold settled up 1%. Silver ended up 5.7%, setting a fresh record close above the $80 an ounce level. And crude oil settled down 2% on the day. Overall, I mean, a few dynamics were in focus. You had that memory and storage and select semis being the big beneficiary of the AI trade. Semis, of course, being helped out from some specific guidance raises amongst companies. And you also had the pro-cyclical rotation, which was the big story on Monday. Metals continuing to be another big winner from this move, with additional support from technical positioning, from the fiscal spending, and from geopolitical factors. You had a bit of a cyclical tailwind as well, with the looming fiscal impulse from the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. You have tariff relief possible in the widely discussed expectations for broadening earnings growth as we get deeper into 2026. Market also has a number of high-profile potential catalysts over the near term. You have NFP on Friday. You have an upcoming Fed chair pick. You have the potential ruling on whether or not the tariffs are even legal. And of course, you have Q4 earnings season set to get underway in the near term. On the data side, final S&P Global Services PMIs for December came in slightly below consensus in its prelim reading. Employment was down, but negligibly, while prices rose sharply. Looking ahead to the rest of the week, Wednesday we'll see the ADP private payrolls for December, December ISM services, JOLTS job openings for November, and October factory orders, Q3 non-farm productivity and unit labor costs, initial claims for the weekend 3rd of January, and the October trade balance will be out on Thursday, and Friday will bring us the December employment report, the preliminary University of Michigan consumer sentiment for January, and October housing starts. All right, let's take a look at our InvestTalk YouTube comment section question bank. Just a reminder, we do post some videos over there on our YouTube channel. Just search InvestTalk with two T's. And while you're over there, if you have a question that is pressing that you just cannot pick up the phone and dial, well, you can leave it right there in the comment section because we like to tackle those as soon as we get them. This one from our friend Payel, or maybe Pavel is what it is. I can't read sometimes. It's a ticker MDLZ, which is Mondelez International. The question says, Mondelez is approaching its 52-week low. What do you think about the company at these levels? Well, Mondelez is one of the largest snack and beverage companies on planet Earth. They're behind some well-known brands, Oreos, Cadbury, Ritz, Sour Patch Kids, my personal favorite. So they sell cookies, chocolates, crackers, gum, and other snacks across the globe. It is a large company, 70 plus billion, $69.64 billion market cap is where they stand right now. It's got very little debt, relatively speaking, only about $16 billion in debt. From a valuation perspective, I mean, it's sitting near the average, just slightly below the average at 17.1 times price to forward-looking earnings. It's ranged from about 16 to 24 over the past 5 years. But, you know, there's a bit of things that are pushing this company and a reason why revenue growth has slowed a bit, right? They're projected to have had $38 billion in revenue in 2025, with guidance showing $39 in 2026, certainly less than that 7.1% growth they've had. Over the past 52 weeks, they're down 9.43%. And so what's driving this? Well, earnings and profit uncertainty, rising commodity and cost pressures, cocoa, sugar, and transportation of these things a bit more expensive than they anticipated. You also have a shift in institutional positioning and a broader market and sector trend of trying to be more healthy, which plays probably a smaller part than some people would think, but still a part nonetheless in a company that primarily sells snacks, cookies, and crackers. So What I'm seeing here is a company that is certainly struggling from a growth perspective. Again, I'll highlight it once more. What, $1.5 billion in revenue growth year over year is certainly slower than the five-year trend. And most of that growth was really from 2022 into 2023. Same time, margins are compressing because of cost pressures. And from a technical perspective, doesn't look great. So not sure what catalysts on the horizon could turn things around for this company. I think it could still become a bit cheaper. So for now, for Mondelez International, gonna have to pass. Going into a break, still to come, my main focus point and more answers to your questions, including one from James from New York. Hang on, you will be next.
For investors, the goal of achieving financial freedom requires unbiased information, strategic planning, and determination. Congratulations! You found the podcast that is dedicated to helping you succeed. InvestTalk.
Let's go to James from New York, who has a question about TTI. How can we help you, James?
So I own this company, and I like it. And lately, you've been getting a lot of questions about water companies. And this one is kind of well diversified, but it also has... is involved with treatment of water and making groundwater potable. And I'd just like to see what your thoughts are on this company. It's been strong. I've done very well with it, but do you see that there's still some strength ahead?
Sure. Let's take a look at Tetra Technologies, Inc. That is ticker TTI. It is a U.S. energy services and solutions company that provides products and services to the oil and gas industries, mainly in completion fluid and additives, and, as James mentioned, in water management. Now, over the past 52 weeks, it's up 154.7%, up 69.9% over the past 3 months, and already up 3.84% year to date. Really, it had weak relative strength until 2021, but since then it's been pretty strong. And the reason being is, while you're seeing a bit of revenue growth from 2020, when revenue was $377 million, now it's $625 million. In terms of debt, they don't have much on their balance sheet, only $207 million in debt on a $1.3 billion market cap company. One concern I have is, in spite of this theme of increased spending on water resources, certainly on energy efficiency for all of the demand out of AI and data centers, growth has slowed quite a bit, right? Most of their growth was from 2021 into 2022. So it's projected to go from $625 million in 2025, because their fiscal year end was in December, so we don't know what their earnings were yet, to only about $651 million the next year. At the same time, though, margins are expanding. EBITDA margin, 17.9%. Return on equity was 56.4% in 2024. Now, it's run up quite a bit. The reasons being as well, strong revenue and earnings signals, some bullish fundamentals, especially from the energy service sector. General strength in oil and gas drilling activity and services demand tends to lift stocks like TTI, so they've certainly been a big beneficiary there. And also their participation in strategic initiatives for water reuse technology for critical minerals projects. And so that's all been a boon to the stock price over the past couple months, but it's put itself in a position where it is a bit expensive. Price to forward-looking earnings now sitting at 37.3 times, well above the average of 23.5. Price to book value well above that average as well. Now, I tend to not like to sell things that are positive momentum, because over shorter periods of time, positive momentum tends to hold. But I would be very cognizant when we get around to middle, end of February, when you start to have earnings come in again, to see what the overall momentum and technical picture is for this stock. So for now, I don't think there's anything wrong with continuing to hold on to this guy. It's been very, very strong and certainly has done very well for you. That is TTI. Tetra Technologies, Inc. Thanks for the call. We got another live call. Jared from Canada. How can we help you?
I'm trying to look into some picks and shovels plays for data center build-outs. So the first one was Bell Fuse, ticker BELFB. And the second one was Amphenol, ticker APH.
Sure. Let's take a look at these two companies. BELFB and APH are the stickers, the tickers rather. So BELFB is Bell Fuse Inc. What they do is they design and manufacture and sell electronic components that power and connect circuits, fuses, and power supplies. Obviously, a clear picks and shovel name here. Now, it's a bit smaller of a business. It's more focused. It has less breadth than the other name that you asked about, which is APH, Amphenol Corporation. It's one of the largest global producers of connectors, of interconnected systems, and fiber optics and sensors. So Bell Fuse is about $2 to $3 billion market cap company, APH, $150 billion. The former Bell Fuse, narrower product mix and end markets, while the other has a bit broader product portfolio across industries. Because Bell Fuse is smaller, it's going to be a bit more subject to the cyclical nature of its specific niches, meaning there's a potential for higher growth, certainly, but if cycles turn, there is a potential for a lot of downside risk there, especially compared to APH. Now, in terms of profitability, higher profitability from APH. Scale is certainly reflected here in the margins and in the return on equity as a comparison. Overall, because of these things, right, because of the relative safety, again, relative safety of APH compared to BELFB due to its broader portfolio, because of its higher profitability, it's trading at a bit of a higher valuation. But between these two companies, I think the higher valuation for APH is certainly justified. You get a broader portfolio, you get a larger company, you get a potentially broader growth profile, and certainly, for now at least, better profitability. Thanks for the call. On the next Invest Talk, we will dig into this story, the 2026 Great Rotation, tech versus the old economy. As 2026 begins, Wall Street consensus is shifting away from the Magnificent Seven and towards old economy cyclicals. So we'll analyze whether the rotation is real or just another head fake. That's tomorrow, but for now, I'm Luke Guerrero, ready to take your calls. This year, give a gift that goes far beyond the moment, an Invest 529 account. Whether it's a child, grandchild, or someone just starting out, you're helping them save for education that could open doors for a lifetime. Invest 529 is a tax-advantaged way to save for college, trade school, or even apprenticeship programs. It's flexible, easy to start, and you can contribute any amount, big or small. You can even invite your friends and family to join in, making it a meaningful group gift. Each contribution helps build a brighter future, one deposit at a time. And because the money can grow tax-free, it's a gift that really builds value over time. So instead of giving something that gets used up or set aside, give the gift that can change a life. Start an Invest 529 account today. Go to invest529.com to get started. I've got something you need to check out. Now, there's ClickUp. If your day starts with 10, 15, 25, or even 40 open tabs, and ends with decision fatigue, because instead of doing your work, you're managing how to manage it. Spreadsheets here, docs there, Slack convos everywhere. It was chaos. But now, there's ClickUp. It brings together projects, docs, conversations, everything in one workspace. ClickUp doesn't just support your workflow, it upgrades it with automation, AI, and customization. It's already trusted by over 4 million teams worldwide, and it helps them finish projects 30% faster. Try ClickUp for free and get 15% off all AI add-ons just for signing up at clickup.com/invest. That's CLICKUP.com/invest. Close your tabs and open ClickUp.
Millions of downloads have proved there's value in every InvestTalk podcast. Call anytime, 24/7, InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
The January barometer. As January is well underway, 2026 is getting underway, Wall Street is already falling back into, well, a familiar habit. And really, it's a habit that we all fall into in some way in our lives. You try to read the entire year from how January goes. In this case, from the market's first few trading days. Every January, narratives, they pop up. They suggest that early gains or early losses somehow reveal where stocks are headed for the next 12 months. Now, it's understandable that people want to have this perspective. It's comforting. It's clean. It feels actionable to see something and then extrapolate beyond what it really means. But history says it's mostly just noise. Seasonal indicators like the January barometer, the first trading day effect, or the first week signal, they've been around for decades. Some of these ideas date back to the 1970s, when market observers tried to connect early year momentum with full year outcomes. And the logic sounds intuitive. Strong starts reflect confidence. Weak starts, they signal caution. The problem is that intuition doesn't survive contact with the data. When researchers look across more than a century of market history, the results are remarkably consistent. Whether the market rises or whether the market falls in early January, the odds of finishing the year higher, unsurprisingly, they barely change at all. Statistically, the market rises in roughly 2 out of every 3 years, and that probability holds regardless of January's opening performance. That finding cuts directly against the idea that early year trading contains any predictive power at all. Even when analysts slice the data different ways, the first day, the first 2 days, the first week, the first full month, the outcome's the same. None of these patterns meets the standard tests of statistical significance used to separate signal from just what is absolute randomness. So in other words, the difference people point to are well within the range of chance. This matters because seasonal indicators often influence investor behavior far more than you realize. When markets dip early in January, fear can creep in unnecessarily. When markets surge, complacency can set in just as quickly. Both reactions are rooted in the belief that January is telling us something profound. In reality, it's just another month, shaped by liquidity, by positioning, by short-term sentiment. Early year moves are often driven by portfolio rebalancing, tax-related flows, institutional position resetting. Those forces can push prices around temporarily without changing the underlying economic or earnings outlook. That's why markets can reverse pretty sharply later in the quarter, making early narratives look pretty foolish in hindsight. The bigger drivers of full-year returns are far more mundane, far more boring. Earnings growth, interest rates, inflation, economic resilience. These forces evolve over months, over quarters, not over a handful of hours or a handful of days. History shows that strong Januaries do not guarantee strong years. But at the same time, weak Januaries don't doom markets either. Investors who anchor too heavily on early season signals risk making emotional decisions disconnected from fundamentals. This is especially important in a year like 2026, where macro uncertainty, where policy shifts, where valuation questions, they loom pretty large, larger than any calendar effect. The temptation, and I get it, it's understandable, the temptation to treat January as some sort of crystal ball, I get it, but it's rarely helpful. Markets don't reveal their intentions through first impressions. They reveal them through sustained trends and through changes in fundamentals. The real takeaway then is simple. The odds of stocks rising in 2026 are not improved or impaired by how January begins. So, for all of you out there, discipline beats folklore, and long-term outcomes are shaped by patience, not seasonal superstition. Let's keep things moving. Play another listener question now.
I have a quick question. I am 26 and I'm wondering how much I should be contributing to my 401k. I make $80,000 a year and I can contribute up to $20,000 a year and my employer matches 6%, but I'm not sure if that's like way too much, the $20,000 to contribute versus having that in other brokerage accounts. Thanks so much. Bye.
That's a great question, and certainly you are on the right track here. I think one of the biggest mistakes everybody makes, or not everybody, but a lot of people make, is they lock up all their money in their 401k. They lock up all their money in their IRA. They lock up all their money in their Roth. And frankly, there's an opportunity cost to that. Taxable brokerage accounts can have a benefit as well. Now, 401ks are great. They are great investment vehicles. They are people's primary savings vehicle, especially early on in their careers. And the best part about them, sure, they can be tax advantaged, or rather they are tax advantaged in some way. But the best part about them is the match. It is free money from your employer. But there's a downside. For most people, their 401k, they have limited fund options for many reasons. One, primarily being because of liability of the employer, but we won't really get into that. So you are giving up freedom of choice of your investment options for a match. Meaning, in my opinion, once you've hit that match, you should be putting your money elsewhere. Either a traditional IRA, a Roth if you qualify. And once you've maxed those out, a traditional brokerage account. Saving is good. But what also matters is where you save and what options you have for investing in those various accounts. Thanks for the call. This is Invest Talk, and we are all about answering questions. So let's do two in a row.
Hey, Duncan from New York. Thank you for all that you do. I am now doing some New Year's cleaning right now with one of my portfolios. I am looking to sell two stocks, top stock ticker HPE and stock ticker PYPL, PayPal. It is about 5% total in my portfolio, looking to utilize it for some extra cash and for some tax loss harvesting. I'm looking to just get rid of it because I think there have been the lowest performer ones. I know that PayPal is losing market share, I believe, to Google and Apple because of Google and Apple Pay. And HPE, I really just got it for the dividend, but I feel like I can use that cash for something else, kind of like robotics or nuclear energy. So looking forward to your advice and have a great day. Bye. A
lot to unpack there. First and foremost, I would argue time to do tax loss harvesting is actually before the start of the new year. Why? Because there's uncertainty about tax rates in the future. Money today is worth more than money next year. And so whenever you can, especially if you want to divest from a name, you want to realize those losses as soon as possible. That being said, you know what? Better late than never. Now for PayPal, you are correct. PayPal is a name we held a while back for our clients, but it has over a long period of time now started to, or rather continue to lose market share to Apple Pay, to Google Pay, or whatever they call it over there on Google phones, to crypto transactions, digital transactions. And it's struggled. Its revenue has struggled. Its growth has struggled. And the company has struggled because of it, down 33% over the past 52 weeks. So I think PayPal is a great candidate for selling out of. Your other one, HPE, has struggled a bit as well. My issue, and one thing I want to highlight for you, is you said you invested in it for the dividend. I generally don't like investing in something for a dividend. The dividend should not be the only reason that you are investing in a company. Now let's take a look at HPE's dividend history here. So HPE had about 2.4% dividend yield, 2.2% dividend yield. But going back to 2020, it's been pretty weak relative to the rest of the market. It underperformed the market by 41.5% in 2020. Underperformed by 17.8 in 2023. And so, you know, you're investing in that dividend, but it also matters what you're holding on to as well. Dividends can be great signals of a healthy company that can return capital to shareholders, that has profitability, all these things, but it should not be the only reason you invest in something. So as the new year begins, I think selling out of these things, investing in better opportunities is a good way to start. Thanks for the call. Looks like we got another live call. Steve from Atlanta, how can we help you?
Hello. Just I want to ask you about Hyatt, letter H, for long-term hold.
Sure. Let's take a look at Hyatt. Hyatt, of course, is Hyatt Hotels Corporation. Big hotel chain, so they operate and franchise a global portfolio of hotels, resorts, and vacation properties. It is a mid-cap to kind of larger mid-cap company, $15 to $16 billion market cap with a decent yield as well, right? It's not big, but it's pretty consistent at around 40 basis points. The exception being, well, during the pandemic when hotels were not making a lot of money. Now, revenue growth has been pretty solid, 5.7% on an annualized basis is the revenue growth over the past 5 or 6 years. Revenue projected to be $7 billion at the end of 2025. Their fiscal year ended in December. Projected to go again to $7.2 billion. At the same time, margins expanding. EBITDA margin 16.4, up from 12% the year before. Projected to grow even more to 17.5 this upcoming year. Now, it looks a little expensive relative to the industry, but not relative to where it's been. Price to forward-looking earnings at 44.1 times is still well below the average of 66 times. Price to book value on the higher end of its range. Price to cash flow 62.4 times. Now, why is this company doing well? Because over the past 3 months, it's up 13.61%. Its relative strength gap between it and the S&P 500 has certainly been closing in the near term. And one of the reasons why is, well, an expansion of brands and growth of the World of Hyatt loyalty program globally has boosted repeat bookings. Real estate and asset sales that they did help to optimize their portfolio. Travel has not gone anywhere. Global travel demand is going to dictate how companies like Hyatt do. Recently, quarterly results did include revenue growth, but were mixed or modest on earnings. But things are looking up in terms of guidance going forward. And so this is going to be entirely tied to the economic cycle, right? Hospitality demand is cyclical. Profitability looks solid, but operating margins and earnings can be a bit thin when costs rise, or cyclical when occupancy softens. And there's a bit of valuation sensitivity here relative to other companies. So I like the idea because I think that demand for travel is still very robust. My concern here, though, is a bit about the valuation. So it's trying to break out of a trend here. I don't know. I think I like the idea. I might look elsewhere within the travel space. That is Hyatt Hotels Corporation, ticker H. Thanks for the call. Well, the Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, is striking an unusually upbeat tone, arguing that 2026 could deliver faster U.S. economic growth, just as tax refunds and lower withholding from the One Big Beautiful Bill Act begin to hit household cash flow. The tax law effectively delivers 2 years of tax cuts in one, injecting roughly $191 billion into the economy and potentially adding 30 basis points to GDP at a time when growth in 2025 likely slowed to around 1.9%. That fiscal boost could be amplified by the end of last year's prolonged government shutdown, with pent-up federal spending returning to in 2026 and adding another estimated 60 basis points to GDP. Weakened tax enforcement following deep IRS cuts may quietly add further stimulus, as well as lost collections could amount to another 25 basis points or more if historical patterns hold. Now, there is a bit of a counterweight here, right? Tariffs are the main counterweight in the near term, since existing duties are set to raise far more revenue in 2026 and gradually erode consumer purchasing power through higher prices. But drag may prove temporary. You have to remember, the Supreme Court may strike down roughly half of the tariffs imposed under emergency powers, a decision that could arrive any moment. I know I read recently that the Supreme Court is set to announce some decisions on Friday at 10 a.m. Eastern. Such a ruling would likely trigger large refunds to companies that paid unlawful tariffs in 2025, potentially worth around 50 basis points of GDP, while also reducing tariff revenue this upcoming year. With fewer workable alternatives to replace that revenue quickly, the overall federal budget stance could turn unexpectedly even more stimulative rather than contractionary. These are all the things that we have to think about as we move into 2026 for reasons why growth in the U.S. economy may pick up. And it doesn't stop there. Monetary policy is also likely to ease in 2026, with rates already down sharply from their 2024 peak and more cuts possible as the president prepares to appoint a more dovish Fed leadership. That tilt towards looser policy would reduce the risk of a sharp market downturn, helping sustain equity prices, household wealth, and capital spending tied to AI investment boom. Now, some economists see this upside extending globally with fiscal expansion in Germany, policy support in China and Japan, and lower oil prices reinforcing demand outside the US. Now, this all sounds good, but you have to understand there are some risks as well, and you should keep this in your mind when you're framing your outlook. The main risk is that simultaneous fiscal and monetary stimulus could reignite inflation or inflation fears, and push long-term interest rates higher. But recent years have shown the economy's ability to outperform gloomy forecasts, leaving room for the Treasury Secretary's optimism to be tested in 2026. This is InvestTalk. I'm Luke Greer. We have one goal: to help you achieve your financial freedom. Our work continues after this break, our final break, so get your questions in now at 888-99-CHART.
Are free, the unbiased answers are free. So what are you waiting for? Call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
Hey guys, this is Craig from the mountains outside Seattle. I've called a few times before. I wanted to call about VYMI, the Vanguard International High Yield Dividend Fund. My Roth IRA and my HSA are pretty much the three largest holdings are AVGE, AVGV, and DFAW. So I've got some international exposure there, but I have supplemented that with AVNV, and I'm thinking about VYMI. My concern with VYMI is it's got a 41% concentration in the financials, and I'm not sure. I wanted to get your thoughts on how smart that is in 2026. Being a fully international fund and with that much concentration in the financial sector, or if I should just stick with AVNV, far more value tilt, but nowhere near the dividend since they're both post-tax accounts. You know, I like the idea of the dividend, but I don't know if the volatility will be worth it. So I wanted to get your thoughts on that. Again, VYMI. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Great question. And certainly, you know, I have a lot of familiarity with DFA funds, being that I used to work at Dimensional and all those guys went off and started Avantis. And their funds tend to have tilts towards value, tilts towards profitability, but don't explicitly pick things based on high dividend yield, which it looks like VYMI, which is the Vanguard International High Dividend Yield ETF, does. They take a conservative approach to international high dividend yield. So they rank by forecasted yield over the next 12 months. And those in the top half are selected. So they combine that with a market cap weighting and effectively get a large basket that doesn't depart from the broad market as radically as some competitors, but still focuses primarily as a sorting mechanism being dividend yield. Now, VYMI, from the looks of it, has a fair bit of concentration in the financial sector, which is something that you're just going to see, right? If you take a look at its investable universe, it is the MSCI ACWI All Country World Index, ex-US High Dividend Yield. If you're looking for a high dividend yield ETF, the benchmark, the investable universe, is 34% financial. So they're overweight about 9%. Nothing that's too crazy. Certainly if I'm constructing an ETF, that would be well within any sector cap that I would have. I just think that the explicit quote-unquote cost of investing in an international high dividend yield ETF is just going to be having a lot of financial names. Let's take a look at the other fund that you mentioned. I forgot what it was, so we're not going to take a look at it. But the Avantis Fund. It does not explicitly look for high dividend yielding names within its portfolio construction, so I imagine it has a lower financial weight. But when you take a look at this, I mean, it's got 1,504 holdings. The top 10 holdings have 17.39%. It is a broadly diversified ETF. You're not going to get very much company-specific risk. Most of your risk is going to be concentrated, again, by your sector exposure, in this case, financials. It sounds like you're a bit hesitant. I understand being hesitant, but keep in mind, this is also probably a smaller portion of your portfolio, so your effective weight in financials is lower than you'd assume. Either way, you know from listening to this show, I tend to tell people not to chase high dividend yield and have that be an explicit choice, I think that lesson still rings here. That is the Vanguard International High Dividend Yield ETF. Thanks for the call. Now, unfortunately, we do not have much time to go over yet another interesting story about the ramifications of database build out on the US electrical grid and the fears that demand could outplace supply during these periods of extreme heat and cold. And really what's that done for tech companies and how there is more than ever an adversarial relationship between those tech companies and the cities in which they have placed these database centers. But I promise you, unless Justin has talked about it at some point before I get back with you on Friday, we will talk all about this story, which I think is an interesting one, when I'm back with you all on Friday. Well, that does it. That completes another episode of the Invest Talk podcast. Justin and I thank you for listening. And more than anything, we encourage you to tell one friend, one family member about our free podcast downloads, which of course you can get on iTunes, you can get on Spotify, you can get anywhere you listen to your podcasts. And we do also post some of this content on YouTube. So head over to our YouTube channel, search Invest Talk with two T's. If today's show made you think about your own financial picture, if your New Year's resolution is to get it all under control, and you think, you know what, self, I think I need a second opinion. Well, Justin and I talk to people just like you each and every day, because at KPP Financial, we offer no cost confidential portfolio reviews to help bring a little bit of clarity and confidence to your financial life. That sounds interesting. Head over to investtalk.com and click on the portfolio review button. Independent thinking, shared success. This is Invest Talk. Good night.
Invest Talk is a trademark of KPP Financial. Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for the listener to understand that not all comments made will apply to them. Specifically, nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell security. Because such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor firm which retains all rights. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. Thank you for listening, and your comments and questions are welcome on our 24-hour listener line at 888-99-CHART.